planes circled, an entire network of transportation, never mind various government and law enforcement agencies, was waiting for this man facing a woman who said she didn't love him anymore. It's that airplane, isn't it? Eve nodded. They're all dead. Everybody on board. All dead. Kelly's eyes flared with concern. How? What could it be? That's what I have to go find out. Eve felt the urgency of his job settling over him now. He had blown it with Zack, but that was done, and now he had to go. He reached into his pocket and handed her an envelope with the pinstriped logo. For tomorrow afternoon, he said, in case I don't make it back before then. Kelly peeked at the tickets, her eyebrows lifting at the price, then tucked them back inside the envelope. She looked at him with an expression approaching sympathy. Just be sure not to forget our meeting with Dr. Kempner, the family therapist, the one who would decide Zack's final custody. Kempner, right, he said. I'll be there. And be careful, she said. Eve nodded and started away. JFK International Airport. A crowd had gathered outside the airport, people drawn to the unexplained, the weird, the potentially tragic, the event. The radio on Eve's drive over treated the dormant airplane as a potential hijacking, speculating about a link to the conflicts overseas. Inside the terminal, two airport carts passed Eve, one carrying a teary-eyed mother holding the hands of two frightened-looking children, another with an older black gentleman riding with a bouquet of red roses across his lap. He realized that somebody else's Zack was out there on that plane, somebody else's Kelly. He focused on that. Eve's team was waiting for him outside a locked door, just below gate 6. Jim Kent was working the phone, as usual, speaking into the wire microphone dangling from his ear. Jim handled the bureaucratic and political side of disease control for Eve. He closed his hand around the mic part of the phone wire and said, by way of greeting, "No other reports of planes down anywhere else in the country." Eve climbed in next to Nora Martinez in the back of the airline cart. Nora, a biochemist by training, was his number 2 in New York. Her hands were already gloved, the nylon barrier as pale and smooth and mournful as lilies. She shifted over a little for him as he sat down. He regretted the awkwardness between them. They started to move, Eve smelling marsh salt in the wind. How long was that plane on the ground before it went dark? Nora said, 6 minutes. No radio contact? Pilots out too? Jim turned and said, presumed, but unconfirmed. Port Authority cops went into the passenger compartment, found it full of corpses, and got right out again. They were masked and gloved, I hope. Affirmative. The car turned a corner, revealing the airplane waiting in the distance. A massive aircraft, work lights trained on it from multiple angles, shining as bright as day. Mist off the nearby bay created a glowing aura around the fuselage. Christ, said Eve. Jim said, a 777, they call it. The 777, the world's largest twin jet. Recent design, new aircraft. Why they're flipped out about the equipment going down. They think it's something more like sabotage. The landing gear tires alone were enormous. Eve looked up at the black hole that was the open door over the broad left wing. Jim said, they already tested for gas. They tested for everything man-made. They don't know what else to do but start from scratch. Eve said, us being the scratch. This dormant aircraft, mysteriously full of dead people, was the hazmat equivalent of waking up one day and finding a lump on your back. Eve's team was the biopsy lab charged with telling the Federal Aviation Administration whether or not it had cancer. Blue blazer-wearing TSA officials pounced on Eve as soon as the cart stopped, trying to give him the same briefing Jim had just had, asking him questions and talking over each other like reporters. This has gone on too long, said Eve. Next time something unexplained like this happens, you call us second, hazmat first, us second. Got it? Yes, sir, Dr. Goodweather. Is hazmat ready? Standing by. Eve slowed before the CDC van. I will say that this doesn't read like a spontaneous contagious event. 6 minutes on the ground? The time element is too short. It has to be a deliberate act, said one of the TSA officials. Perhaps, said Eve. As it stands now, in terms of whatever might be awaiting us in there, we have containment." He opened the rear door of the van for Nora. "We'll suit up and see what we've got." A voice stopped him. "We have one of our own on this plane." Eve turned back. "One of whose?" "A federal air marshal. Standard on international flights involving U.S. carriers." "Armed?" said Eve. "That's the general idea." "No phone call, no warning from him?" "No, nothing." "Must have overpowered them immediately," Eve nodded, looking into these men's worried faces. "Get me his seat assignment. We'll start there." Eve and Nora ducked inside the CDC van, closing the rear double doors, shutting out the anxiety of the tarmac behind them. They pulled level A hazmat gear down off the rack. Eve stripped down to his t-shirt and shorts, Nora to a black sports bra and lavender panties, each accommodating the other's elbows and knees inside the cramped Chevy van. Nora's hair was thick and dark and defiantly long for a field epidemiologist, and she swept it up into a tight elastic, arms working purposefully and fast. Her body was gracefully curved, her flesh the warm tone of lightly brown toast. After Eve's separation from Kelly became permanent and she initiated divorce proceedings, Eve and Nora had a brief fling. It was just one night, followed by a very awkward and uncomfortable morning after, which dragged on for months and months, right up until their second fling, just a few weeks ago, which, while even more passionate than the first and full of intention to avoid the pitfalls that had overwhelmed them the first time, had led again to another protracted and awkward détente. In a way, he and Nora worked too closely. If they had anything resembling normal jobs, a traditional workplace, the result might have been different, might have been easier, more casual. But this was love in the trenches, and with each of them giving so much to Canary, they had little left for each other, or the rest of the world. A partnership so voracious that nobody asked, "How was your day?" in the downtime, mainly because there was no downtime at all. Such as here. Getting practically naked in front of each other in the least sexual way possible. Because donning a bio suit is the antithesis of sensuality. It is the converse of allure. It is a withdrawal into prophylaxis, into sterility. The first layer was a white Nomex jumpsuit, emblazoned on the back with the initials CDC. It zipped from knee to chin, the collar and cuffs sealing it in snug Velcro, black jump boots lacing up to the shins. The second layer was a disposable white suit made of papery Tyvek. The booties pulled on over boots, and Silver Shield chemical protective gloves over nylon barriers taped at the wrists and ankles. Then lifted on self-contained breathing apparatus gear, a SCBA harness, a lightweight titanium pressure demand tank, full-face respirator mask, and personal alert safety system PASS device with a firefighter's distress alarm. Each hesitated before pulling the mask over his or her face. Nora formed a half-smile and cupped Eve's cheek in her hand. She kissed him. "You okay?"
"Yep."
"You sure don't look it. How is Zach?"
"Sulky.
Pissed, as he should be."
"Not your fault."
"So what? Bottom line is, this weekend with my son is gone, and I'll never get it back." He readied his mask. "You know, there came a point in my life where things came down to either my family or my job. I thought I chose family. Apparently not enough. There are moments like these, which usually come at the most inconvenient of times, such as a crisis, when you look at someone and realize that it will hurt you to be without them." Eve saw how unfair he had been to Nora by clinging to Kelly. Not even to Kelly, but to the past, to his dead marriage, to what once was, all for Zach's sake. Nora liked Zach, and Zach liked her. That was obvious. But now, right now, was not the time to get into this. Eve pulled on his respirator, checking his breathing tank. The outer layer consisted of a yellow, canary yellow, full encapsulation spacesuit, featuring a sealed hood, a 210-degree viewport, and attached gloves. This was the actual Level A containment suit, the contact suit, 12 layers of fabric which, once sealed, absolutely insulated the wearer from the outside atmosphere. Nora checked his seal, and he did hers. Biohazard investigators operate on a buddy system, much the same way as that of scuba divers. Their suits puffed a bit from the circulated air. Sealed-out pathogens meant trapping sweat and body heat, and the temperature inside their suits could rise up to 30 degrees higher than room temperature.
"Looks tight," said Eve over the voice-actuated microphones inside his mask. Nora nodded, catching his eye through their respective masks. The glance went on a moment too long, as if she was going to say something else, then changed her mind.
"You ready?"
she said. Eve nodded.
"Let's do this."
Outside on the tarmac, Jim switched on his wheeled command console and picked up both mask-mounted cameras on separate monitor feeds. He attached small switched-on flashlights on lanyards from their pull-away shoulder straps. The thickness of the multi-layered suit gloves limited the wearer's fine motor skills. The TSA guys came up and tried to talk to them some more, but Eve feigned deafness, shaking his head and touching his hood. As they approached the airplane, Jim showed Eve and Nora a laminated printout containing an overhead view of the interior seat assignments, numbers corresponding to passengers and crew manifests listed on the back. He pointed to a red dot at 18A.
"The Federal Air Marshal," Jim said into his microphone. "Last name, Charpentier. Exit row, window seat."
"Got it," Eve said. A second red dot. TSA pointed out this other passenger of interest, a German diplomat on the flight, Rolf Hubermann, business class, second row, seat F, in town for UN Council talks on the Korean situation. Might have been carrying one of those diplomatic pouches that get a free pass at customs. Could be nothing, but there is a contingent of Germans on their way here right now from the UN, just to retrieve it.
Okay.
Jim left them at the edge of the lights, turning back to his monitors. Inside the perimeter, it was brighter than day. They moved nearly without shadow. Eve led the way up the fire engine ladder onto the wing, then along its broadening surface to the open door. Eve entered first. The stillness was palpable. Nora followed, standing with him shoulder to shoulder at the head of the middle cabin. Seated corpses faced them, in row after row. Eve's and Nora's flashlight beams registered dully in the dead jewels of their open eyes. No nosebleeds. No bulging eyes or bloated, mottled skin. No foaming or bloody discharge about the mouth. Everyone in his or her seat, no sign of panic or struggle. Arms hanging loose into the aisle, or else sagged in laps. No evident trauma. Mobile phones, in laps, pockets, and muffled inside carry-on bags emitted waiting message beeps, or else rang anew, the peppy tones overlapping. These were the only sounds. They located the air marshal in the window seat just inside the open door, a man in his 40s with black receding hair, dressed in a baseball-style button-up shirt with blue and orange piping, New York Mets colors, the baseball-headed mascot Mr. Met depicted on the front, and blue jeans. His chin rested on his chest, as though he were napping with his eyes open. Eve dropped to one knee, the wider exit row giving him room to maneuver. He touched the air marshal's forehead, pushing back the man's head, which moved freely on his neck. Nora next to him teased her flashlight beam in and out of his eyes, Charpentier's pupils showing no response. Eve pulled down on his chin, opening his jaw, and illuminating the inside of his mouth, his tongue, and the top of his throat, looking pink and unpoisoned. Eve needed more light. He reached over and slid open the window shade, and construction light blasted inside like a bright white scream. No vomit, as from gas inhalation. Victims of carbon monoxide poisoning evince distinct skin blistering and discoloration, leaving them with a bloated, leathered appearance. No discomfort in his posture, no sign of agonal struggle. Next to him sat a middle-aged woman in resort-style travel wear, half-glasses perched on her nose before her unseeing eyes. They were seated as any normal passengers would be, chairs in the full and upright position, still waiting for the fastened seatbelt sign to be turned off at the airport gate. Front exit row passengers stow their personal belongings in mesh containers bolted to the facing cabin wall. Eve pulled a soft Virgin Atlantic bag out of the pocket before Charpentier, running the zipper back along the top. He pulled out a Notre Dame sweatshirt, a handful of well-thumbed puzzle books, an audiobook thriller, then a nylon pouch that was kidney-shaped and heavy. He unzipped it,
just far enough to see the all-black, rubber-coated handgun inside. "You seeing this?" said Eve.
"We see it," said Jim over the radio.
Jim, TSA, and anyone else with enough rank to get near the monitors were watching this whole thing on Eve's shoulder-mounted camera.
Eve said, "Whatever it was, took everyone completely unaware, including the air cop."
Eve zipped the bag closed and left it on the floor, straightening, then proceeding down the aisle. Eve reached across the dead passengers in order to raise every second or third window shade, the harsh light casting weird shadows and throwing their faces into sharp relief, like travelers who had perished by flying too close to the sun. The phones kept singing, the dissonance becoming shrill, like dozens of personal distress alarms overlapping. Eve tried not to think about the concerned callers on the other end. Nora moved close to a body. "No trauma at all," she noted.
"I know," said Eve. "Goddamn spooky."
He faced the gallery of corpses, thinking, "Jim," he said, "get an alert out to WHO Europe. Bring in Germany's Federal Ministry of Health on this, contacting hospitals. On the off chance this thing is transmissible, they should be seeing it there, too."
"I'm on it," said Jim.
In the forward gallery between business and first, four flight attendants, three female, one male, sat buckled into their jump seats, bodies pitched forward against their shoulder belts. Moving past them, Eve had the sensation of floating through a shipwreck underwater. Nora's voice came through. "I'm at the rear of the plane, Eve. No surprises. Coming back now."
"Okay," said Eve as he walked back through the window-lit cabin, opening the segregating curtain to the wide aisle seats of business class.
There Eve located the German diplomat, Hubermann, sitting on the aisle near the front. His chubby hands were still folded in his lap, his head slumped, a forelock of sandy silver hair drooped over his open eyes. The diplomatic pouch Jim mentioned was in the briefcase beneath his seat. It was blue and vinyl with a zipper along the top. Nora approached him.
"Eve, you're not authorized to open that."
Eve unzipped it, removing a half-eaten Toblerone bar and a clear plastic bottle full of blue pills.
"What is it?"
Nora asked.
"My guess is Viagra," said Eve, returning the contents to the pouch and the pouch to the briefcase.
He paused next to a mother and a young daughter traveling together. The young girl's hand was still nestled inside her mother's. Both appeared relaxed.
Eve said, "No panic, no nothing."
Nora said, "Doesn't make sense."
"Viruses require transmission, and transmission takes time. Passengers becoming sick or falling unconscious would have caused uproar, no matter what the fasten seatbelt sign said. If this was a virus, it was unlike any pathogen Eve had ever encountered in his years as an epidemiologist with the CDC. All signs instead pointed to a lethal poisoning agent introduced into the sealed environment of the airplane cabin.
Eve said, "Jim, I want to retest for gas."
Jim's voice said, "They took air samples, measured in parts per million. There was nothing."
"I know, but it's as if these people were overcome by something without any warning whatsoever. Maybe the substance dissipated once that door opened. I want to test the carpeting and any other porous surfaces. We'll test lung tissue once we get these people in post."
"Okay, Eve, you got it."
Eve moved quickly past the widely spaced leather-appointed seats of first class to the closed cockpit door. The door was grated and framed in steel along each edge, with an overhead camera in the ceiling. He reached for the handle.
Jim's voice in his suit hood said, "Eve, they're telling me it works on a keypad lock. You won't be able to get..."
The door pushed open under his gloved hand. Eve stood very still at the open doorway. The lights from the taxiway shone through the tinted cockpit windshield, illuminating the flight deck. The system displays were all dark.
Jim said, "Eve, they're saying to be very careful."
"Tell them thanks for the expert technical advice," said Eve before moving inside. The system displays around the switches and throttles were all dark. One man wearing a pilot's uniform sat slumped in a jump seat to Eve's immediate right as he entered. Two more, the captain and his first officer, were seated in the twin chairs before the controls. The first officer's hands lay curled and empty in his lap, his head drooped to the left with his hat still on. The captain's left hand remained on a control lever, his right arm hanging off the armrest, knuckles brushing the carpeted floor. His head was forward, his hat resting in his lap. Eve leaned over the control console between the two seats in order to push up the captain's head. He checked the captain's open eyes with his flashlight, the pupils fixed and dilated. He eased the man's head back down, gently onto his chest, and then stiffened. He felt something. He sensed something. A presence. He stepped back from the console and scanned the flight deck, turning in one complete circle.
Jim said, "What is it, Eve?"
Eve had spent enough time around corpses not to be jumpy, but there was something here, somewhere. Here or nearby. The strange sensation passed like a dizzy spell, leaving him blinking. He shook it off.
Nothing. Claustrophobia, probably.
Eve turned to the third man inside the cockpit. His head hung low, his right shoulder propped up against the side wall. His jump seat harness straps hung down. Eve said aloud, "Why isn't he belted in?"
Nora said, "Eve, are you in the cockpit? I'm coming to you."
Eve looked at the dead man's silver tie pin with the Regis Air logo. The nameplate over his pocket read, "Redfern." Eve dropped to one knee before him, pressing his thickly gloved fingers against the man's temples to raise his face. His eyes were open and downturned. Eve checked his pupils and thought he saw something, a glimmer. He looked again, and suddenly Captain Redfern shuddered and emitted a groan. Eve jerked backward, falling between the two captain's chairs and against the control console with a clatter. The first officer slumped against him, and Eve pushed back at him, trapped for a moment by the man's limp, dead weight. Jim's voice called to him sharply, "Eve?"
Nora's voice held a note of panic.
"Eve, what is it?"
With a surge of energy, Eve propelled the first officer's body back into its chair and got to his feet.
Nora said, "Eve, you all right?"
Eve looked at Captain Redfern, spilled onto the floor now, eyes open and staring. His throat, though, was working, bucking. His open mouth seemed to be gagging on the air. Eve said, wide-eyed, "We have a survivor here."
Nora said, "What?"
"We have a man alive here, Jim. We need a curt isolation pod for this man. Brought directly to the wing. Nora?"
Eve was talking fast, looking at the pilot twitching on the floor.
"We have to go through this entire airplane, passenger by passenger."
Interlude 1. Abraham Satrakian. The old man stood alone on the cramped sales floor of his pawn shop on East 118th Street in Spanish Harlem. An hour after closing and his stomach was rumbling, yet he was reluctant to go upstairs. The gates were all pulled down over the doors and windows, like steel eyelids, the night people having claimed the streets outside. At night, you don't go out. He went to the bank of dimmers behind the loan desk and darkened the store lamp by lamp. He was in an elegiac mood. He looked at his shop, the display cases of chrome and streaked glass, the wristwatches showcased on felt instead of velvet, the polished silver he couldn't get rid of, the bits of diamond and gold, the full tea sets under glass, the leather coats and now controversial furs, the new music players that went fast, and the radios and televisions he didn't bother taking in anymore. And there were here and there treasures. A pair of beautiful antique safes lined with asbestos, but just don't eat it. A suitcase-size wooden steel Quasar VCR from the 1970s. An antique 16mm film projector. But on balance, lots of low-turnover junk. A pawn shop is part bazaar, part museum, part neighborhood reliquary. The pawnbroker provides a service no one else can. He is the poor man's banker, someone people can come to and borrow $25, with no concern as to credit history, employment, references. And in the grip of an economic recession, $25 is real money to many people. $25 can mean the difference between shelter or homelessness. $25 can put life-prolonging medicine within reach, so long as a man or woman has collateral. Something of value to borrow against. He or she can walk out of his door with cash in hand. Beautiful. He trudged on upstairs, turning out more lights as he went.
He was fortunate to own his building, bought in the early 1970s for $7 and change. Okay, maybe not for so little, but not for so much either. They were burning down buildings for heat back then. Knickerbocker Loans and Curios, the name came with the shop, was never a means to wealth for Satrakian, but rather a conduit, a point of entry into the pre-internet underground marketplace of the crossroads city of the world, for a man interested in old-world tools, artifacts, curios, and other arcana. 35 years of haggling over cheap jewelry by day, while amassing tools and armaments by night. 35 years of biding his time, of preparation and waiting. Now his time was running out. At the door, he touched the mezuzah and kissed his crooked, wrinkled fingertips before entering. The ancient mirror in the hallway was so scratched and faded that he had to crane his neck in order to find a reflective patch in which to view himself. His alabaster white hair, starting high up on his creased forehead and sweeping back below his ears and neck, was long overdue for a trim. His face continued to fall, his chin and earlobes and eyes succumbing to that bully named gravity. His hands, so broken and badly mended so many decades before, had curved into arthritic talons that he kept permanently hidden behind wool gloves with cut-off fingertips. Yet beneath and within this crumbling facade of a man, strength, fire, grit. The secret of his interior wellspring of youth, one simple element: revenge. Many years before, in Warsaw and later in Budapest, there was a man named Abraham Satrakian who had been an esteemed professor of Eastern European literature and folklore. A Holocaust survivor who survived the scandal of marrying a student and whose field of study took him to some of the darkest corners of the world. Now an aged pawnbroker in America, still haunted by unfinished business. He had good soup left over, delicious chicken soup with kreplach and egg noodles, that a regular had brought him all the way from Liebman's in the Bronx. He put the bowl in the microwave and worked at his loose necktie knot with his gnarled fingers. After the beeping, he carried the hot bowl over to the table, pulling a linen napkin, never paper, from the holder and tucking it snugly into his collar. Blowing on soup, a ritual of comfort, of reassurance, he remembered his grandmother, his bube, and this was more than mere memory. It was sense, a feeling, blowing on it for him when he was a boy, sitting next to him at the rickety wooden table in the cold kitchen of their house in Romania, before the troubles. Her old breath stirring the rising steam into his young face, the quiet magic of that simple act, like blowing life into the child. And now, as he blew, an old man himself, he watched his breath given shape by the steam, and wondered just how many of these respirations he had left. He took the spoon, one of a drawer full of fancy mismatched implements, into the crooked fingers of his left hand, blowing into the spoon now, rippling the tiny pool of broth there, before taking it into his mouth. Taste came and went, the buds on his tongue dying like old soldiers, the victims of many decades of pipe smoking, a professor's vice. He found the thin remote for the outdated Sony TV, a kitchen model finished in white, and the 13-inch screen warmed up, further illuminating the room. He rose and walked to the pantry, leaning his hands onto the stacks of books, squeezing the hallway into a narrow tread of worn rug. Books were everywhere, piled high against the walls, many of them red, all of them impossible to part with. And lifting the cover off the cake tin to retrieve the last of the good rye bread he had been saving. He carried the paper-wrapped loaf back to his cushioned kitchen chair, settling heavily, and went about picking off the little bits of mold as he enjoyed another tender sip of the delicious broth. Slowly, the image on the screen claimed his attention. A jumbo jet parked on a tarmac somewhere, lit up like an ivory piece upon jeweler's black felt. He pulled on the black-rimmed glasses that hung at his chest, squinting in order to make out the bottom graphic. Today's crisis was taking place across the river at JFK Airport. The old professor watched and listened, focused on the pristine-looking airplane. 1 minute became two, then three, the room fading around him. He was transfixed, nearly transported by the news report, the soup spoon still in his no longer tremulous hand. The television image of the dormant aeroplane played across the lenses of his eyeglasses like a future foretold. The broth in the bowl cooled, its steam fading, dying, the picked-apart slice of rye bread remaining uneaten. He knew. Pick, pick, pick. The old man knew. Pick, pick, pick. His malformed hands began to ache. What he saw before him was not an omen. It was an incursion. It was the act itself. The thing he had been waiting for, that he had been preparing for, all his life, until now. Any relief he had felt initially at not having been outlived by this horror, at getting one last-minute chance at vengeance, was replaced immediately by sharp, pain-like fear. The words left his mouth on a gust of steam. He is here. He is here. Arrival. Regis Air Maintenance Hangar. Because JFK needed the taxiway cleared, the entire aircraft was towed as is into the Regis Air Longspan Maintenance Hangar in the hour before dawn. No one spoke as the lame 777 full of dead passengers rolled past like an enormous white casket. Once the wheel chocks were put down and the airplane was secured, black tarpaulins were laid out to cover the stained cement floor. Borrowed hospital screens were erected to curtain off a wide containment zone between the left wing and the nose. The plane was isolated in the hangar, like a corpse inside a massive morgue. At Eve's request, the Office of the Chief Medical Examiner of New York dispatched several senior medical-legal investigators from Manhattan and Queens, bringing with them several cartons of rubber crash bags. The OCME, the world's largest medical examiner's office, was experienced in multiple casualty disaster management and helped devise an orderly process of cadaver retrieval. Port Authority hazmat officers in full contact suits brought out the air marshal first, solemnly, officers saluting the bagged corpse as it appeared at the wing door, and then, laboriously, everyone else in the first row of coach. They then removed those empty seats, using the added space to bag the corpses before evacuating them. Each body, one at a time, was strapped to a stretcher and lowered from the wing to the tarp-covered floor. The process was deliberate and, at times, gruesome. At one point, about 30 bodies in, one of the Port Authority officers suddenly stumbled away from the retrieval line, moaning and gripping his hood. Two fellow hazmat officers converged on him, and he lashed out, shoving them into the hospital screens, in effect, breaching the containment border. Panic erupted, people clearing the way for this possibly poisoned or infected officer clawing at his containment suit on his way out of the cavernous hangar. Eve caught up with him out on the apron, where in the light of the morning sun, the officer succeeded in throwing off his hood and peeling off his suit like a constricting skin. Eve grabbed the man who then sank down onto the tarmac, sitting there with sweaty tears in his eyes. "This city," sobbed the officer. "This damn city." Later, word went out that this Port Authority officer had worked those hellish first few weeks on the pile at Ground Zero, first as part of the rescue mission and then the recovery effort. The specter of 9/11 still hung over many of these Port Authority officers, and the current bewildering mass casualty situation had brought it crashing down again. A go team of analysts and investigators from the National Transportation Safety Board in Washington, D.C., arrived aboard an FAA Gulfstream. They were there to interview all involved with the incident aboard Regis Air Flight 753, to document the aircraft's final moments of navigability, and to retrieve the flight data recorder and the cockpit voice recorder. Investigators from the New York City Department of Health, having been leapfrogged by the CDC in the crisis response, were briefed on the matter, though Eve rejected their jurisdiction claim. He knew he had to keep control of the containment response if he wanted it done right. Boeing representatives en route from Washington State had already disclaimed the 777's complete shutdown as mechanically impossible. A Regis Air vice president, roused from his bed in Scarsdale, was insisting that a team of Regis's own mechanics be the first to board the aircraft for inspection once the medical quarantine was lifted. corruption of the air circulation system was the current prevailing cause of death theory. The German ambassador to the United States and his staff were still awaiting their diplomat's pouch, Eve leaving them cooling their heels in Lufthansa's Senator Lounge inside Terminal 1. The mayor's press secretary made plans for an afternoon news conference, and the police commissioner arrived with the head of his counterterrorism bureau inside the rolling headquarters of NYPD's critical response vehicle. By mid-morning, all but 80 corpses had been unloaded. The identification process was proceeding speedily, thanks to passport scans and the detailed passenger manifest. During a suit break, Eve and Nora conferred with Jim outside the containment zone, the bulk of the aircraft fuselage visible over the curtain screens. Airplanes were taking off and landing again outside. They could hear the thrusters gaining and decelerating overhead and feel the stir in the atmosphere, the agitation of air. Eve asked Jim between gulps of bottled water, "How many bodies can the ME in Manhattan handle?" Jim said, "Queens has jurisdiction here, but you're right. The Manhattan headquarters is the best equipped. Logistically, we're going to be spreading the victims out among those two in Brooklyn and the Bronx. So, about 50 each. How are we going to transport them?" "Refrigerated trucks. Medical examiner said that's how they did the World Trade Center remains. Fulton Fish Market in Lower Manhattan. They've been contacted." Eve often thought of disease control as a wartime resistance effort, he and his team fighting the good fight, while the rest of the world tried to get on with their daily lives under the cloud of occupation, the viruses and the bacterium that plagued them. In this scenario, Jim was the underground radio broadcaster, conversant in three languages, who could procure anything from butter to arms to safe passage out of Marseille. Eve said, "Nothing from Germany?" "Not yet. They shut down the airport for 2 hours, a full security check. No employees sick at the airport. No sudden illnesses being reported to hospitals." Nora was anxious to speak. "Nothing here adds up." Eve nodded in agreement. "Go ahead." "We have a plane full of corpses. Were this caused by gas or some aerosol in the ventilation system, accidental or not, they would not have all gone so, I have to say, so peacefully. They would have been choking, flailing, vomiting, turning blue. People with different body types going down at different times. An attendant panic. Now, if instead this was an infectious event, then we have some kind of crazy, sudden, totally new emerging pathogen, something none of us have ever seen, indicating something man-made, created in a lab. And at the same time, remember, it's not just the passengers who died. The plane itself died, too. Almost as though something, some incapacitating thing, hit the airplane itself and wiped out everything inside it, including the passengers. But that's not exactly accurate, is it? Because I think this is the most important question of all right now. Who opened the door?" She looked back and forth between Eve and Jim. "I mean, it could have been the pressure change. Maybe the door had already been unlocked and the aircraft's decompression forced it open. We can come up with cute explanations for just about anything because we're medical scientists. That's what we do." "And those window shades," said Jim. "People always look out the windows during landing. Who closed them all?" Eve nodded. He had been so focused on the details all morning, it was good to step back and see strange events from a distance. "This is why the four survivors are going to be key, if they witnessed anything," Nora said, "or otherwise involved." Jim said, "All four are in critical but stable condition in the isolation wing at Jamaica Hospital Medical Center. Captain Redfern, the third pilot, male, 32, a lawyer from Westchester County, female, 41, a computer programmer from Brooklyn, male, 44, and a musician, a celebrity from Manhattan and Miami Beach, male, 36. His name is Dwight Moorshine." Eve shrugged. "Never heard of him. He performs under the name Gabriel Bolivar." Eve said, "Oh." Nora said, "Ooh." Jim said, "He was traveling incognito in first class. No fright makeup, no crazy contact lenses. So there will be even more media heat." Eve said, "Any connection between the survivors?" "None we see yet. Maybe their med workup will find something. They were scattered throughout the plane. The programmer was flying coach, the lawyer in business, the singer first class, and Captain Redfern, of course, up in the flight deck." "Baffling," said Eve. "But it's something anyway. If they regain consciousness, that is, long enough for us to get some answers out of them.
One of the Port Authority officers came around for Eve. "Dr. Goodweather, you better get back in there," he said. "The cargo hold. They found something." Through the side cargo hatch, inside the underbelly of the 777, they had already begun offloading the rolling steel luggage cabinets to be opened and inspected by the Port Authority hazmat team. Eve and Nora sidestepped the remaining train-linked containers, wheels locked into floor tracks. At the far end of the hold lay a long rectangular box, black, wooden, and heavy-looking, like a grand cabinet laid out on its back. Unvarnished ebony, 8 or so feet long by 4 feet wide by 3 high, taller than a refrigerator. The topside was edged all around with intricate carving, labyrinthine flourishes, accompanied by lettering in an ancient, or perhaps made-to-look ancient, language. Many of the swirls resembled figures, flowing human figures, and perhaps, with a little imagination, faces screaming. "No one's opened it yet?" asked Eve. The hazmat officers all shook their heads. "We haven't touched the thing," one said. Eve checked the back of it. 3 orange restraining straps, their steel hooks still in the floor eyelets, lay on the floor next to the cabinet. "These straps?" "Undone when we came in," said another. Eve looked around the hold. "That's impossible," he said. "If this thing was left unrestrained during transit, it would have done major damage to the luggage containers, if not the interior walls of the cargo hold itself." He looked it over again. "Where's its tag? What does the cargo manifest say?" One of the officers had a sheaf of laminated pages in his gloved hand, bound by a single ring clasp. "It's not here." Eve went over to see for himself. "That can't be. The only irregular cargo listed here, other than 3 sets of golf clubs, is a kayak." The guy pointed to the side wall where, bound by the same type of orange ratchet straps, a plastic-wrapped kayak lay plastered with airline luggage stickers. "Call Berlin," said Eve. "They must have a record. Somebody there remembers this thing. It must weigh 400 pounds, easy." "We did that already. No record. They're going to call in the baggage crew and question them one by one." Eve turned back to the black cabinet. He ignored the grotesque carvings, bending to examine the sides, locating 3 hinges along either top edge. The lid was a door, split down the middle, the long way, 2 half-doors that opened out. Eve touched the carved lid with his gloved hand. Then he reached under the lid, trying to open the heavy doors. "Anybody want to give me a hand?" One officer stepped forward, wrapping his gloved fingers underneath the lip of the lid opposite Eve. Eve counted to 3, and they opened both heavy doors at once. The doors stood open on sturdy, broad-winged hinges. The odor that wafted out of the box was corpse-like, as though the cabinet had been sealed for 100 years. It looked empty, until one of the officers switched on a flashlight and played the beam inside. Eve reached in, his fingers sinking into a rich, black loam. The soil was as welcoming and soft as cake mix, and filled up the bottom 2/3 of the box. Nora took a step from the open cabinet. "It looks like a coffin," said Nora. F withdrew his fingers, shaking off the excess, and turned to her, waiting for a smile that never came. "A little big for that, isn't it?" "Why would someone ship a box of dirt?" she asked. "They wouldn't," Eve said. "There had to be something inside." "But how?" said Nora. "This plane is under total quarantine." Eve shrugged. "How do we explain anything here? All I know for sure is we have an unlocked, unstrapped container here without a bill of lading." He turned to the others. "We need to sample the soil. Dirt retains trace evidence well. Radiation, for example." One of the officers said, "You think whatever agent was used to overcome the passengers was shipped over in here? That's the best theory I've heard all day." Jim's voice called from below them outside the plane. "F! Nora!" F called back. "What is it, Jim?" "I just got a call from the isolation ward at Jamaica Hospital. You're going to want to get over there right away." Jamaica Hospital Medical Center. The hospital facility was just 10 minutes north of JFK along the Van Wyck Expressway. Jamaica was one of the 4 designated centers for bioterrorism preparedness planning in New York City. It was a full participant in the Syndronic surveillance system, and Eve had run a canary workshop there just a few months before, so he knew his way to the airborne infection isolation ward on the 5th floor.
The metal double doors featured a prominent blaze orange tri-petaled biohazard symbol, indicating a real or potential threat to cellular materials or living organisms. Printed warnings read, "Isolation area. Contact precaution mandatory. Authorized personnel only." Eve displayed his CDC credentials at the desk, and the administrator recognized him from previous biocontainment drills. She walked him inside. "What is it?" he asked. "I really don't mean to be melodramatic," she said, waving her hospital ID over the reader, opening the doors to the ward, "but you need to see it for yourself." The interior walkway was narrow, this being the outer ring of the isolation ward occupied by the nurse's station. Eve followed the administrator behind blue curtains into a wide vestibule containing trays of contact supplies, gowns, goggles, gloves, booties, and respirators, and a large rolling garbage barrel lined with a red biohazard trash bag. The respirator was an N95 half-mask, efficiency rated to filter out 95% of particles 0.3 microns in size or larger. That meant it offered protection from most airborne viral and bacteriological pathogens, but not against chemical or gas contaminants. After his full contact suiting at the airport, Eve felt positively exposed in a hospital mask, surgical cap, barrier goggles, gown, and shoe covers. The similarly attired administrator then pressed a plunger button, opening an interior set of doors, and Eve felt the vacuum light pull upon entering, the result of the negative pressure system, air flowing into the isolation area so that no particles could blow out. Inside, a hallway ran left to right off the central supply station. The station consisted of a crash cart packed with drugs and ER supplies, a plastic-sheathed laptop, an intercom system for communicating with the outside, and extra barrier supplies. The patient area was a suite of 8 small rooms. 8 total isolation rooms for a borough with a population of more than 2.25 million. Surge capacity is the disaster preparedness term for a healthcare system's ability to rapidly expand beyond normal operating services to satisfy public health demands in the event of a large-scale public health emergency. The number of hospital beds in New York State was about 60,000 and falling. The population of New York City alone was 8.1 million and rising. Canary was funded in the hopes of mending the statistical shortfall, as a sort of disaster preparedness stopgap. The CDC termed that political expedience optimistic. Eve preferred the term magical thinking. He followed the administrator into the first room. This was not a full biological isolation tank. There were no airlocks or steel doors. This was routine hospital care in a segregated setting. The room was tile-floored and fluorescently lit. The first thing Eve saw was the discarded Kurt pod against the side wall. A Kurt pod is a disposable, plastic-boxed stretcher, like a transparent box coffin, with a pair of round glove ports on each long side and fitted with removable exterior oxygen tanks. A jacket, shirt, and pants were piled next to it, cut away from the patient with surgical scissors, the Regis Air-winged crown logo visible on the overturned pilot's hat. The hospital bed in the center of the room was tented with transparent plastic curtains, outside which stood monitoring equipment and an electronic IV drip tray laden with bags. The railed bed bore green sheets and large white pillows and was set in the upright position. Captain Doyle Redfern sat in the middle of the bed, his hands in his lap. He was bare-legged, clad only in a hospital johnny, and appeared alert. But for the IV pick in his hand and arm, and the drawn expression on his face, he looked as though he had dropped 10 pounds since Eve had found him inside the cockpit. He looked for all the world like a patient awaiting a checkup. He looked up hopefully as Eve approached. "Are you from the airline?" he asked. Eve shook his head, dumbfounded. Last night this man had gasped and tumbled to the floor inside the cockpit of Flight 753, eyes rolling back into his skull, seemingly near death. The thin mattress creaked as the pilot shifted his weight. He winced as though from stiffness and then asked, "What happened on the plane?" Eve couldn't hide his disappointment. "That's what I came here hoping to ask you." Eve stood facing the rock star Gabriel Bolivar, who sat perched on the edge of the bed like a black-haired gargoyle draped in hospital johnny. Without the fright makeup, he was surprisingly handsome,
in a stringy-haired, hard-living way. "The mother of all hangovers," Bolivar said.
"Any other discomfort?" asked Eve.
"Plenty. Man."
He ran his hand through his long black hair.
"Never fly commercial. That's the moral of this story. Mr. Bolivar, can you tell me what is the last thing you remember about the landing?"
"What landing? I'm serious. I was hitting the vodka tonics pretty hard most of the flight. I'm sure I slept right through it."
He looked up, squinting into the light.
"How about some Demerol, huh? Maybe when the refreshment cart swings by?"
Eve saw the scars crisscrossing Bolivar's bare arms and remembered that one of his signature concert moves was cutting himself on stage. "We're trying to match passengers with their possessions."
"That's easy. I had nothing. No luggage. Just my phone. Charter plane broke down. I boarded this flight with about 1 minute to spare.
Didn't my manager tell you?"
"I haven't spoken to him yet. I'm asking specifically about a large cabinet."
Bolivar stared at him. "This some kind of mental test?"
"In the cargo area. An old box, partially filled with soil."
"No idea what you're talking about.
You weren't transporting it back from Germany? Seems like the kind of thing someone like you might collect."
Bolivar frowned.
"It's an act, dude. A fucking show, a spectacle. Goth grease paint and hardcore lyrics. Google me up. My father was a Methodist preacher, and the only thing I collect is pussy. Speaking of which, when the hell am I getting out of here?"
Eve said, "We have a few more tests to run. We want to give you a clean bill of health before we let you go.
When do I get my phone back?"
"Soon," said Eve, making his way out.
The administrator was having trouble with three men outside the entrance to the isolation ward. Two of the men towered over Eve and had to be Bolivar's bodyguards. The third was smaller and carried a briefcase and smelled distinctly of lawyer. Eve said, "Gentlemen, this is a restricted area." The lawyer said, "I'm here to discharge my client, Gabriel Bolivar. Mr. Bolivar is undergoing tests and will be released at the earliest possible convenience."
"And when will that be?"
Eve shrugged. 2, maybe 3 days, if all goes well.
"Mr. Bolivar has petitioned for his release into the care of his personal physician. I have not only power of attorney, but I can function as his health care proxy if he is in any way disabled."
"No one gets in to see him but me," said Eve. To the administrator, he said, "Let's post a guard here immediately." The attorney stepped up.
"Listen, doctor, I don't know much about quarantine law, but I'm pretty sure it takes an executive order from the president to hold someone in medical isolation. May I, in fact, see said order?"
Eve smiled. "Mr. Bolivar is now a patient of mine, as well as the survivor of a mass casualty. If you leave your number at the nurse's desk, I will do my best to keep you abreast of his recovery. With Mr. Bolivar's consent, of course."
"Look, Doc," the attorney put his hand on Eve's shoulder in a manner Eve did not like. "I can get quicker results than a court injunction simply by mobilizing my client's rabid fan base." He included the administrator in his threat. "You want a mob of goth chicks and assorted freaks protesting outside this hospital, running wild through these halls, trying to get in to see him?"
Eve looked at the attorney's hand until the attorney removed it from his shoulder. He had 2 more survivors to see.
"Look, I really don't have time for this. So let me just ask you some questions straight out. Does your client have any sexually transmitted diseases I should know about? Does he have any history of narcotics use? I'm only asking, because if I have to go look up his entire medical record, well, those things have a way of getting into the wrong hands. You wouldn't want his full medical history leaked out to the press, right?"
The attorney stared at him.
"That is privileged information. Releasing it would be a felony violation."
"And a real potential embarrassment," said Eve, holding the attorney's eye another second for maximum impact.
"I mean, imagine if somebody put your complete medical history out there on the internet for everyone to see."
The attorney was speechless as Eve started away past the 2 bodyguards. Joan Luss, law firm partner, mother of 2, Swarthmore grad, Bronxville resident, junior league member, was sitting on a foam mattress in her isolation ward hospital bed, still tied up in that ridiculous Johnny, scribbling notes on the back of a mattress pad wrapper. Scribbling and waiting and wiggling her bare toes. They wouldn't give her back her phone. She'd had to cajole and threaten just to get a lead pencil. She was about to buzz again when finally her nurse walked in the door. Joan turned on her get-me-results smile. "Hi, yes, there you are. I was wondering, what was the doctor's name who was in here?" "He's not a doctor from the hospital." "I realized that. I was asking his name." "His name is Dr. Goodweather." "Goodweather." She scribbled that down. "First name?" "Doctor." Her flat smile. "They all have the same first name to me. Doctor." Joan squinted as if she wasn't sure she'd heard that right, and shifted a bit on the stiff sheets. "And he was dispatched here from the Centers for Disease Control?" "I guess so, yes. He left orders for a number of tests. How many others survived the crash?" "Well, there was no crash." Joan smiled. Sometimes you had to pretend that English was their second language in order to make yourself understood. "What I am asking you is, how many others did not perish on Flight 753 from Berlin to New York?" "There are three others in this wing with you. Now, Dr. Goodweather wants to take blood, and..." Joan tuned her out right there. The only reason she was still sitting in this sick room was because she knew she could find out more by playing along. But that ploy was nearing its end. Joan Luss was a tort attorney, tort being a legal term meaning a civil wrong, recognized as grounds for a lawsuit. A plane full of passengers all die except for four survivors, one of whom is a tort attorney. Poor Regis Air. As far as they would be concerned, the wrong passenger had lived. Joan said, talking right over the nurse's instructions, "I would like a copy of my medical report to date, along with a complete list of lab tests already performed and their results. Mrs. Luss, are you certain you feel all right?" Joan had swooned for a moment, but it was just a remnant of whatever had overcome them at the end of that horrible flight. She smiled and shook her head fiercely, asserting herself anew. This anger she was feeling would power her through the next 1,000 or so billable hours spent sorting through this catastrophe and bringing this dangerously negligent airline to trial. She said, "Soon I will feel very well indeed." Regis Air Maintenance Hangar. "No flies," said Eve. Nora said, "What?" They were standing before rows of crash bags laid out before the airplane. The four refrigerated trucks had pulled inside the hangar, sides respectfully canvassed in black to obscure the fish market signage. Each body had already been identified and assigned a barcoded toe tag by the office of the Chief Medical Examiner of New York. This tragedy was a closed-universe mass disaster, in their parlance, with a fixed and knowable number of casualties, the opposite of the collapse of the Twin Towers. Thanks to passport scans, passenger manifests, and the intact condition of the remains, identification of the decedents was a simple, straightforward task. Determining the cause of their deaths was to be the real challenge. The tarp crinkled under the hazmat team's boots as the blue vinyl bags were hoisted by straps at either end and loaded aboard their appointed truck with all solemnity. Eve said, "There should be flies." The work light set up around the hangar showed that the air above the corpses was clear but for a lazy moth or two. Why aren't there any flies? After death, the bacteria along the digestive tract that, in life, cohabitated symbiotically with the healthy human host, begins to fend for itself. It starts feeding on the intestines, eventually eating its way through the abdominal cavity and consuming the organs. Flies can detect the putrid off-gassing from a decomposing carcass as far as 1 mile away. 206 meals were set out there. The hangar should have been buzzing with pests. Eve started across the tarp toward where a pair of hazmat officers was sealing another crash bag. "Hold on," he said to them. They straightened and stepped back as Eve knelt and unzipped the seam, exposing the corpse inside. It was the young girl who had died holding her mother's hand. Eve had memorized her body's location on the floor without realizing it. You always remember the children. Her blonde hair lay flat, a smiling sun pendant hanging from a black cord rested against the pit of her throat. Her white dress made her look almost bride-like. The officers moved on to seal and take the next bag. Nora came up behind Eve, watching him. With his gloved hands, he grasped the girl gently by the sides of her head, rotating it on her neck. Rigor mortis fully sets in about 12 hours after death, holding for 12 to 24 more hours. They were in that middle range now, until the fixed calcium bonds inside the muscles break down again and the body returns to flexibility.
"Still flexible," said Eve.
"No rigor."
He grasped her shoulder and hip and rolled the girl over onto the front.
He unbuttoned the back of her dress, revealing the flesh of her lower back, the small bulbous nodes of her spine. Her skin was pallid and lightly freckled.
After the heart stops, blood pools inside the circulatory system. The capillary walls, being just one cell thick, soon succumb to the pressure, bursting and spilling blood into the surrounding tissues. This blood settles in the lowest, dependent side of the body and coagulates quickly. Lividity is said to become fixed after about 16 hours. They were beyond that time limit now. From expiring in a seated position and then being laid out flat, the pooled, thickened blood should have rendered the skin along her lower back a deep, dark purple.
Eve looked out over the rows of bags.
Why aren't these bodies decomposing as they should?
Eve eased the girl back flat again, then thumbed open her right eye with a practiced hand. Her cornea was clouded, as it should have been, and the sclera, the opaque white protective layer, was suitably dry. He examined the fingertips of her right hand, the one that had been tucked into her mother's, and found them slightly wrinkled due to evaporation, as they should have been. He sat back, annoyed by the mixed signals he was receiving, then inserted his two gloved thumbs between her dry lips. The gasp-like noise that escaped from her parted jaw was the simple venting of gas. The immediate interior of the mouth was unremarkable, but he wriggled one gloved finger inside to depress her tongue, checking for more dryness. The soft palate and tongue were completely white, as though carved in ivory, like anatomical netsuki. The tongue was rigid and oddly erect. Eve manipulated it to the side and revealed the rest of the mouth, equally drained.
Drained. What's next, he thought.
The bodies have been drained. There's not a drop of blood left. If not that line, then one from a Dan Curtis 1970s TV horror show. Lieutenant, the corpses, they're drained of blood. Cue organ music. Fatigue was starting to set in.
Eve held the firm tongue between his thumb and index finger, using a small flashlight to peer down her white throat. It looked vaguely gynecological to him. Porn Netsuki?
Then the tongue moved. He jerked back, pulling out his finger.
Jesus Christ.
The girl's face remained a placid mask of death, lips still slightly parted.
Nora, next to him, stared.
What was it?
Eve was wiping his gloved finger on his trousers.
Simple reflex action, he said, standing.
He looked down at the girl's face until he couldn't look any more, then drew the zipper up along the bag, sealing her inside.
Nora said, what could it be? Something that slows tissue decay somehow? These people are dead.
In every way except decomposition.
Eve shook his head uneasily. We can't hold up the transport. Bottom line is, we need these bodies at the morgue. Cut them open. Figure out this thing from the inside.
Nora, he noticed, was gazing off in the direction of the ornate cabinet, laid out on the hangar floor away from the rest of the unloaded luggage.
Nothing's right about this, she said.
Eve was looking the other way, at the great aircraft overhead. He wanted to get back aboard. They must have missed something. The answer had to be in there.
But before he could do this, he saw Jim Kent escorting the director of the CDC inside the hangar. Dr. Everett Barnes was 61 years old, and still very much the southern country doctor he had started out as. The public health service that the CDC was a part of had been born of the Navy, and though the PHS had long since branched off on its own, many CDC officials still favored military-style uniforms, including Director Barnes. So you had the contradiction of a folksy, down-home, white-goateed gentleman dressing like a retired admiral in a trim khaki field uniform complete with chest candy, looking very much like a combat-decorated Colonel Sanders. After the preliminaries and a cursory examination of one of the airplane dead, Director Barnes asked about the survivors.
Eve told him, none of them has any memory of what happened. They are no help at all.
Symptoms?
Headaches, some severe muscle pain, ringing in the ears, disorientation, dry mouth, problems with balance.
Director Barnes said, Generally not much worse than anyone else getting off a transatlantic flight.
It's uncanny, Everett, said F. Nora and I were the first ones on the plane. These passengers, all of them, were flatlined, not breathing. 4 minutes without oxygen is the threshold for permanent brain damage. These people, they might have been out for more than an hour.
Evidently not, said the director.
And they couldn't tell you anything?
They had more questions for me than I had for them.
Any commonality among the four?
I'm pursuing that now. I was going to ask your help in confining them until our work is done.
Help? We need these four patients to cooperate.
We have their cooperation.
For now, we can't take any chances. The director smoothed down his trim white beard as he spoke.
I'm sure that with a little tactical use of bedside manner, we can leverage their appreciation for having been spared this tragic fate and keep them compliant. His smile revealed an upper row of heavily enameled dentures.
What about enforcing the Health Powers Act?
Ephraim, you know there is a world of difference between isolating a few passengers for voluntary preventive treatment and confining them in quarantine. There are larger issues, media issues to be frank, to consider.
Everett, I'm going to have to respectfully disagree.
The director's small hand came down gently on Eve's shoulder. He exaggerated his drawl a bit, maybe in order to soften the blow.
Let me save us both some time here, Ephraim. Looking at this objectively now, this tragic incident is, thankfully, one might say, blessedly contained. We've had no other deaths or illnesses on any other airplanes or in any other airports around the globe in what is approaching 18 hours since that plane landed. These are positives, and we must stress them. Send a message to the public at large, reinforcing their confidence in our system of air travel. I am certain, Ephraim, that engaging these fortunate survivors, appealing to their sense of honor and duty, will be enough to compel them to cooperate. The director removed his hand, smiling at Eve like a military man humoring his pacifist son.
Besides, continued Barnes, this is all the hallmarks of a goddamn gas leak, doesn't it? So many victims so suddenly incapacitated, the closed environment, and the survivors rallying after being removed from the plane.
Nora said, except that the air circulation quit when the electrical did, right after landing.
Director Barnes nodded, folding his hands in consideration of this.
Well, it's a lot to process, no question. But look here, this was a very good drill for your team. You've handled it well, and now that things appear to be settling down, let's see you get right to the bottom of it, just as soon as this damn press briefing is done with.
Eve said, hang on.
What?
The mayor and the governor are holding a press conference along with airline representatives, port authority officials, and so on. You and I will represent the federal health response.
Oh, no, sir, I don't have the time. Jim can do that.